Accession number 28361, Reel 8.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 8. I was asking you how the soldiers of the Enniskillen Fusiliers took to being led by students.
Well,
company and platoon level.
Well, they were quite used to it because they'd been the demonstration battalion for about a year, but they certainly made their feelings known if you made a mistake in your map reading. On the other hand, it did help that they'd done many of the exercises before, because they could say not that way, so this way. But they were full of humour, and it was great fun.
So they could save you from yourself.
They could save you from themselves, yourself. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And you mentioned fighting in built-up areas. Had you not done any of that before?
We had done a very little of it. There was a fighting in built-up areas complex in Malta, fair enough. Just one house more or less made of concrete. And nothing very exciting, but of course it was nothing compared to the Imber village, and I'm not talking about the old Imber village, not what's there now, which is new. And you could do some really quite exciting fighting in built-up areas there with armour and all those sort of things. Can I just?
Yeah, of course. Explaining about the fighting in built-up areas.
Yes. I'd never done it with armour before or all the bits and pieces that one could do it with at Ormonster, and so it made it more interesting.
What are the basic principles that you learned about fighting in built-up areas while you were there?
Well, the one is, the one that we're hearing about so much at the moment, of course, is that it takes a lot of people, a lot of men, it absorbs huge numbers of troops, the more damage you do to the place, the more difficult you might make it for yourself getting through it, because you block up the streets and you create rubble in which the enemy can hide and make life difficult for you. The need for very tight control so that you don't start shooting each other. The need for, if you're attacking, being intelligent and using your brains for how you're going to get on, like mouse-holing through the walls rather than going outside each time and risking yourself being shot in the open. And if you're defending it, of course, the need to make the obstacles as dangerous and difficult for the attackers as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And things like not sitting in windows, like you see so many pictures of snipers sitting in windows, your barrel pointing out, being well back into the room so that you're in the darkness. Putting down, if you can, wet sacking or blankets to cut down the dust of the explosion of your weapon so it doesn't give your positions away. And it's a whole new game, really, and there are a great deal of skills involved which are very important to practice if you're ever going to have to do it for real.
Were you practicing defence of built-up areas as much as you were practicing the attack?
We did both, yes, because we one stage, one was the attacker, and then another stage, you were the defender. Mm-hmm. And of course, reality, it wasn't as real as it should have been, because you weren't allowed to do the sort of things you would have done, like mouse-holing through the walls. A lot of the mouse holes were created already. You weren't allowed to create demolitions to make the whole thing tougher and harder and more difficult.
Were you allowed to use grenade?
We used thunder flashes, not real grenades, no. I want to just speak to this guy.
You're saying that you used thunder flash rather than grenades when you were working your way through.
Yes.
A house. The business of clearing a street, would you use a platoon to clear a street or something?
Well, it depends. I mean, you could use a company to clear a street with a platoon going up. It depends on the street and the size of the building. I mean, you could use a platoon on each side, or you could even use a company on each side. It depends on the scale of the building. And if you're going up through a city centre, you'll probably put a company up each side. You might even put a battalion up each side, but the street is the boundary in between. It really depends on the scale of the the enemy and B, the objective.
And what does the armour do? How does the armour assist you?
Well, the armour can do really two things. If it's a village like Imber or a small town and you're on the outskirts of it, it can shoot you in from the outside, as we're seeing happening today in Basra. Once you're into it, it's really got to come in there with you. And you'll use it, of course, to A, take out enemy armour, to clear roadblocks by just blowing them away, by punching holes in the sides of houses to allow you to get in, to take out snipers and fire HE into, post HE in through the windows of buildings, which will explode inside. And you're using it really as a mobile pillbox to give you fire support as you advance down the street.
Then presumably you have to give it protection against bazookas and their modern equivalents.
Exactly, you've got to give it protection against the infantry shoulder-launched anti-tank weapon, against people chucking things like Molotov cocktails down from the windows above, setting it on fire. Also to even maybe spot for mines that are lying in the road and tell it, you know, get out of the way. Don't go there. And also to take out anti-tank guns, which have been sighted in defilade, able to take on the tank as it goes down a street that is behind a house and will take it on in the flank. So once we're into a town like that, the infantry will be very important.
And the artillery, did you practice having artillery support when you
Yes.
And what can they do for you?
Well, they can, again, fire into the town, taking out enemy guns that might be shooting at you, perhaps firing airbursts to discourage anti-tank gunners in the streets, and even firing over open sites and knocking down houses and making holes in them.
That's if the gunners are prepared to actually come into the...
That's if the gunners are prepared to come into the town.
And presumably the self-propelled gunners are more prepared than the...
Yes, than the towed... Yes. Yeah.
And sapper support, was that provided for you in theory or practice on your
physical exercise? In theory it was, yes. And so sappers are very important in fighting in built-up areas for blasting holes, for clearing obstacles and clearing booby traps and mines.
Another area of specialist fighting, which I think they concentrate on to a certain extent nowadays at PCDC, is fighting in woods and forests. Do you remember if there was a particular phase of training devoted to that?
No, we didn't. We didn't do it in fighting in woods and forests. No, no, we didn't.
But how long was the platoon commander's course in those days? Was it a 3 month?
It was about course? 12 weeks. Yes, it was about a 12-week course. Yeah.
And what happened after you'd finished that?
Right. Well, after we finished that, we all split up and went back.
Went our separate ways.
We went back to the Royal Marine Barracks at Eastney, where the the chap responsible for appointing us, the military secretary, came down and said, these are the various jobs we've got available. Where would you like to go? And he immediately said, there's a vacancy to be a machine gun platoon commander. So I stuck my hand up, so I got it.
Which commander was that in? The one
well,
you come from? Or?
That was initially to go back to 40 commander. Mm. But after I'd done the machine gun course, I was sent to another commander, which was actually in England. And so I spent some time with them first. And I can come on to that in a minute, if you like.
Where did you do the machine gun course?
I did that at Netheravon, the School of Infantry Support Weapons Wing, Netheravon.
And what did, you know, what was involved in that?
Well, to begin with, before I went there, I went to the Royal Marine Support Weapons Wing to do a quick buff up to learn about machine guns before I got there. And this was because the machine gun school required all officers attending the course to have had some familiarity with the weapon beforehand. So if you came from an infantry battalion and you went to see your own machine gun officer and said, please can you tell me something about machine guns? Mm. And so I was virtually doing the same. Mm. And the Vickers machine gun course was, I think it was 12 weeks long, and we're now in chronologically in the end of 1956. Mm. So it's middle of September through to the middle of December this course lasts. And what they were teaching you was how to be a machine gun platoon commander. So they were teaching you not only how the thing worked and how to be a machine gunner, they're also teaching you how to command a machine gun platoon and how to instruct. You actually came out of it as an instructor, how to teach the art of machine gunnery.
What was the concept, the role of the Vickers gun?
The Vickers machine gun was, at that stage, in a commander or an infantry battalion, was the CO's personal direct fire support for whatever he wanted to do. And not any direct fire, of course, because the Vickers machine gun could also be used in the indirect role. With a Mark 8Z ammunition, it could fire out to a range of 4,500 yards. So you could take on targets that were out of sight of the gun positions. You could fire over hills to a degree. You could fire at night. So there was a very flexible weapon.
How many of them would you have in a platoon?
You'd have an infantry battalion had six, a commander had four. Mm.
Were they used singly? Or they
no,
used
in pairs. There was the technique and doctrine was they always fired in pairs.
What was the reason for that?
Well, they had a very high stoppage rate. So by having two, you could guarantee fire support. If one stopped, you had something like 14 stoppages and seven specials or something like that. So it was like 21 stoppages you had to learn, including sort of bits that broke. And you machine gun... The machine gunner carried a satchel about that big full of spares, which he was trained to replace in action.
In the field?
In the field, there, while he was firing. He'd pick the thing up, take something out, stick something in, you know. A new lock spring. He carried a spare lock. And then he'd put the spare lock in and take the old lock out, and his number two would be repairing it while the gun was firing.
The whole lock entire, the whole assembly?
The whole assembly. Mm.
How long would that take then to switch locks if one broke down?
If one broke down, it would take about as long as it took to open the cover, do this, take the lock off, put the new one on, close the cover, 15 seconds? And all this clearing of stoppages was done against the clock. Oh. And you learnt it and practiced it in your spare time in the evenings.
Did you have to do it blindfold?
You had to do it. You had to do it. No, I didn't think we ever did it blindfold, but you certainly had to be able to do it in the dark. Yeah, I didn't remember doing it blindfold.
And how many men would you have per gun?
Right, you had three men per gun. The number one, and the number two, who fed the ammunition, and the number three, who trying to remember what the number three did now. The number three was a spare ammunition carrier, as far as I remember.
Who was dealing with the coolant?
The coolant was in a water jacket round the gun, and then it had a tube which went into a condenser can which was full of water. So as it boiled, the steam went into the condenser can and condensed back into water again, so you theoretically didn't lose any liquid. Of course you did. And then what you did when it became overheated, or you then there was a little spigot on the top which you undid with and it had a funnel, and you poured the water back in. But you didn't have to do that very often because of the condenser can. You weren't losing all that amount of liquid actually.
How was the weapon moved?
It was moved either in trucks, carriers, jeeps, or mules. You could take it to bits and put it on a mule.
Was it ever man-packed?
Yeah, yes, you had to man-pack it. And so you broke it down And how you carried it was the number one carried the barrel, the number two carried the tripod, and the number three carried liners of ammunition.
And these are very substantial loads, aren't
they? Oh, yeah. I mean, the tripod weighed 50 pounds. Mm. The barrel weighed 40-something pounds with water in it. And then you'd load up the number three with liners of ammunition.
Much ammunition as you could possibly
handle. Yeah, and the condenser can full of water. Mm. Yes, they were substantial loads. And a man-packed machine gun was not really a viable proposition because you couldn't carry enough ammunition to keep it in action for any length of time.
Was the idea that it was a weapon primarily for formal actions or that it was a weapon for opportunity targets?
Well, it was both, actually, because if you were doing a advance to contact, you would allocate to a company a section of machine guns in their vehicles and a section of mortars, say. And either the company commander would say, I don't like that position over there, I may have to attack it, come into action and be prepared to cover me forward, in which case the machine guns would go into action. And by going into action, I mean they would get the guns out of the tripods, and put the gun would be put on the tripod, it would be loaded, and so it would be sitting there in action. And the mortars, similarly, they would come in, their base plates would go down, bipods in, ready to fire. Or, when they hit trouble, and they then were going to do an attack, the machine gun section commander automatically would bring his guns into action, ready to support the company. But on an opportunity target basis, if you were in defence, for example, you would have certain places marked out for your targets, your machine gun targets.
DFs
to protect you, and harassing fire tasks on the enemy. Mm. And so the DFs and some of the harassing fire tasks would be pre-planned, but there could be a situation where somebody says, hey, there are a lot of enemy forming up by that barn over there. Can we have some machine gun fire onto it? And then you'd bring fire down onto it.
Were you practicing the old art of creating a beaten zone when you were doing these DFs?
Yeah, because a machine gun beaten zone is like a banana in shape, like that. And the ideal way of covering, say, a rifle company, if your rifle company is the machine guns with this company cover the front of that, and the machine guns with this company cover the front of that, because they're laying the beaten zone down at its most effective. They're laying it along the length.
It's transverse fire, then.
Yeah, and when you fired a Vickers, you see pictures in films of them just giving a short burst. Well, that's not how you fire a Vickers machine gun. You always fire a 3-second burst, and all machine gunners are taught to count 1 banana, 2 banana, 3 banana, which is a 3-second burst, and then you tap the machine gun off left and right of center, and the handles are set at a tightness, so that if you do that and you strike the side of the machine gun handles,
a glancing blow,
it'll knock it off an exact amount of half a degree, so it'll give you overlapping, so you fire 3-second burst, tap, 3-second burst, tap. So you've done 1, 2, 3. Then you go back, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So you actually lay down a carpet of fire. Sorry. Ooh, dear, what's happened? There it is.
So you've got a carpet of fire extending along the length of the... How long would the banana be?
Depends on the range, and therefore how cocked up the gun is. Mm. But you're talking about sort of 50 yards. So you're laying down a banana there, one there, one there. Then you're coming back, one there, one there, one there, one there, one. So you're laying down effectively 5 bananas side by side, and you just repeat it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth,
so
back,
you've
back
got
and forth.
5 times 50. That's
yeah.
About.
And then what you do is you up the range by half a degree. Ah. So you then lay 5 bananas that side, 5 bananas. So if you're doing a machine gun program, you're laying down a huge amount of fire onto the target.
And The rate of fire is high, isn't it?
So the rate of fire is not as high as a GPMG. Mm. It's about 250 rounds a minute.
So a 3-second burst would be quite a substantial body of...
Yes.
And the main problem surely would be ammunition resupply if you were doing sustained fire.
Exactly. So you've got to stock ammunition in if you're going to sustain fire,
Well, was that part of the MG course that you did? The business of organising resupply? And
The business of organising your platoon, because the platoon sergeant is responsible for resupply of the machine gun platoon. And in my day, had a one-ton truck just full of ammunition. And his job was to go around the sections.
Dishing it out.
A section is two guns.
So he'd have two sections.
He'd have two sections, and his job would be to keep them up to speed with ammunition. And then, of course, he's then responsible for going to the RSM, who's responsible for ammunition supply in a battalion or a commando, and getting more ammunition. There's a seventh man in a machine gun section, who's the range taker. Oh. They had a bar. We used to have a bar and stride range finder to give us precise ranges. Mm. And then there's the section commander, who's a sergeant.
And he would presumably be an overall charge of the whole.
He's in charge of the two guns.
Two
yes.
Guns.
That's right. Yeah.
And what about the question of servicing and maintenance of the weapons? Was that done by the within the platoon, or was that done by specialist armourers?
No, it was done the training on maintenance was very high, so they could repair with the parts they had or parts that were brought up to them, up to a certain level. So they were, what they couldn't do was make the parts, obviously. So any more sophisticated repair of guns would have to be done by the armourer. And for example, a machine gun platoon carried quite a lot of spare barrels with you, because the barrels would wear out. So you had to know how to change barrels. And it was a very technically demanding job being a machine gunner, because the barrels had asbestos string wrapped round them to act as waterproofing in the gland in the water jacket, because the barrel of a Vickers machine goes backwards and forwards inside the jacket, and therefore what you don't want is all the water spurting out each end while it does it.
How would you know when a barrel was wearing out?
Well, you knew I can't remember now, but after firing a certain number of rounds through it, you knew the barrel would wear out, so you just changed it.
This presumably means then you have to keep accurate records of how much ammunition you put through each.
Yes.
Who does that? Is that the sergeant's job?
That's the section commander will know how many programs the gun has fired, and so he will be responsible for checking on that. I mean, it's not an exact science, but if you think you've fired too many, then you just change the barrel just in case.
So you did 12 weeks of that. Were you also involved in practicing the tactics of deploying and...
Yeah, you did not only the technical bit of how it worked, and so in effect, what you were doing for part of that 12 weeks was learning how to be a machine gunner. I mean, it's the old practice that the army does, you first learn how to do it and then you learn how to command it.
Yes.
And the next bit was the tactical use of machine guns. So you then went out to the Salisbury Plain on the excellent ranges, and you fired a lot of live ammunition, and you did night exercises, sighting, of machine guns, moving them into position, withdraw. You did all the phases of war, usually with live ammunition, on Salisbury Plain.
And the machine gun roll in it?
You did the machine gun roll in it. Mm-hmm. So you were being given orders as if you were the machine gun platoon commander in a battalion, and you had to then sight the gun. You advised the CO on where they should be sighted.
What are the characteristics of a good sight for a machine gun position?
A machine gun position ideally should be what's known as sighted in defilade. Mm. So that if you're the enemy and this is a hill, I'll sight my gun here and it'll shoot. I'm protecting that company there, and so I'm shooting like that. You can't see me.
So I get hit in the side.
You get hit in the side as you come up.
Final approach.
Absolutely. Mm. Or you can use defilade by the shape of the hill. So if it's a shallow sort of hill, if you're below the crest, you can fire over the top or get them as they come over the crest. So you can't see the position from a long way away. And sighting and defilade is the sort of number one test of a good machine gun. Because there's no point in having a machine gun in a position which is easily spotted by the enemy and will be taken out by tanks.
Was it the normal drill to dig them in?
Yes.
In a pit?
Oh yes, yes. There's a special pit for a machine gun position. It takes a lot of effort to dig a machine gun position.
Well, you've got the weapon itself, the 3-man, and presumably ammunition as well.
Yeah. So there's a lot of space, and takes because you dig the gun down. And you put a platform in, which is big enough to take the tripod, which is probably the size of the platform, will be the size of these two sofas put together. Mm. And then you've got to dig round it where you stand, and then you probably need to put overhead protection over the top.
Mm. And you would presumably have to sight your weapons in consultation with the local tactical
commander. Yes. I mean, what the routine would be. If you're a commander of a battalion was taking up a defensive position, the CO, if he was wise, would delegate the sighting of the machine guns. He would decide where the rifle companies were going to go, and he'd say to the machine gun platoon, well, come back to me with your plan for sighting the machine guns.
So you go
into your own recce, and he'd come back, and if he didn't agree with it, he'd tell you, and he'd say, no, actually, I don't like that, I want that. Mm. But he wouldn't waste his time, not if he was a good CO, running around doing your job for you.
What sort of targets were you actually firing at on the range in the sort of thing? Were you firing at screen targets?
We were firing mainly at bunches of the figure 11s and figure 12s.
Mm. And what sort of scale of formation or unit were they simulating with those targets? Platoons? Or
platoons, really. I mean, they weren't as many targets as you'd like to have had, but there were some. And you could always tell by the state of the ground round them whether you were hitting or not, because they'd tear, the machine gun, a couple of Vickers machine guns really tears the ground up, actually.
Was there any thinking or instruction about the use of the weapon in an anti-aircraft role?
Yes, you went through how to sight it in the anti-aircraft role, but it was very much a sort of ha-ha-ha, last resort, if you've got to do this, boys, you're in trouble sort of stuff,
Well, frequently you are in trouble.
You are. But you can sight the Vickers in the anti-aircraft role, but it hasn't got an anti-aircraft sight, a ring sight on it. Mm. And
it would only be useful against low level.
Only against low level, and really, I wouldn't like to do it, frankly. Mm.
So you've done your machine gun officer's training. Did you go to the 40 Commando after that?
No, I then went to 42 Commando, 42. who were in Bickley, in Devon. They'd been brought back from the Mediterranean, and in fact, what then happened was that there was already a machine gun officer there, but they were short of people to take people through the commando course. So I then spent the next nine months, taking young Marines and officers through the commando course, which actually I found very interesting. I enjoyed it.
So you were on the other side of the line there?
I was on the other side of the line, as an instructor.
Mm. Had there been any changes to the commando course since you had done it?
No, I mean, I'd done it 2 years before, and there really hadn't been many changes, 3 years before. Mm.